Coming up, got Adam Mattes from All-NBA and DNVR talking about the Western Conference playoffs, the Nuggets, the Rockets, and what have we learned in this year's playoff as well, and what it means for the future of team building in the NBA. That's all coming up right now. All right, to preview the Western Conference side of the semifinals and talk about some of the teams that have been eliminated, including the Denver Nuggets, it's Adam Mattes from a DNVR and the All-NBA show. Adam, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. I'm fully in off-season mode. Like when your team is done and you're just on a rhythm, I'm fully there.
Well, the Nuggets, the biggest surprise upset loss in the first round, considering the fact Minnesota didn't have Anthony Edwards, Dante DiVincenzo, or Ayo Dosunmu in the closeout game. Number one thing that popped up to me watching this serious loss against the Wolves was it was the athletic disparity between Minnesota and Denver. And then you got Peyton Watson, restricted free agent, going to be tough or impossible for them to match whatever contract offer he gets. They have very little draft capital. Christian Brown looks like a potential albatross contract. So the big question on my mind, Adam, is what's the path to closing this gap? And also, what was the number one thing that stood out to you as well watching that series loss?
Well, I mean, the athleticism gap was huge. And really, it was where that athleticism gap showed up, particularly Denver's inability to dribble the ball to get into their offense. So it was ball handling. Denver lacked ball handlers, and in particular, ball handlers with athleticism. And then defensively, you know, Denver didn't have guys that could match up not only with their main guys, Anthony Edwards, Jaden McDaniels, but then as guys got hurt, you saw Terrence Shannon Jr. come into the game, really a third string scoring type come in, and Denver couldn't guard him either. And so the athleticism gap, I think, was a huge one. We've known it for a while was an issue with Denver, but I think it might have gone disguised just how big. I think Minnesota really uncorked Denver's weakness in 2024, that they were going to wear Murray out and they were going to press that advantage. I think teams learn that from them, as teams often do. You look and say, where are they vulnerable? You saw OKC exploit that same advantage. And that was with Russell Westbrook. Denver lost Russell Westbrook this year, and I think you just saw in the series, they looked completely outmatched and outclassed physically from a speed standpoint, from an ability to get to the paint standpoint. And ultimately, I think it's their undoing, not just for the season, but now it is a hole on their roster that they have to figure out. And maybe that would require them shifting gears.
I mean, you mentioned Murray getting targeted, worn out. I mean, with Jokic not able to space the floor to three, it felt like Murray was unable to create any quality space off the dribble himself, unable to get into the paint. Defensively, a non-factor as well. What did you see from that series that was so different compared to the regular season, in which he was an all-star? It was his best regular season of his career. What shifted in that first round against Minnesota for Murray?
I think a little bit of this was the game plan is always to wear him out. So they're going to use a lot of different people on him. They're going to get physical with him. And even if he beats you early, you trust that over the course of the games and over the course of the series, he's going to run out of steam. But I think it was even worse than that as the series went on, that he wasn't even having good first quarters. It wasn't even like, all right, just stick to the game plan. It was immediately he was swallowed up physically by Jaden McDaniels. Denver couldn't screen to get him free. And what it exposed, it's not just that this took away one of Denver's identities. Like, okay, you took away one of their punches. It disrupted the entire offense because he is the one that has to initiate it. Think about it. Jokic was not getting the ball in the post. He was not getting the ball in the short roll. He got it maybe four or five times he was in the short roll. So being able to take Murray out of what he does also took Denver collectively out of what they did, and they didn't have another option. Now, some of this was the unique injuries to Denver. One of their other initiators is Aaron Gordon. They basically have three initiators, Jokic, Murray, and AG. You take out AG, and you take out Jamal just because you can eliminate him from the game. And Jokic was both the finisher and the trigger of every offensive possession. So I think it hurt them there as well. But that's the point, is it wasn't just they were able to slow Jamal Murray down. It was by virtue of taking Murray out, they had nobody but Jokic to enter the ball. And they had nobody but Jokic to finish the play either. So he had to both initiate and finish.
I mean, I talked about this during the series, how at one point, I believe this is still the case, the Jokic Murray two-man game was posting their worst efficiency in two-man actions, pick and rolls and handoffs since their first playoff series ever back in 2019 against the Spurs. They scored 0.91 points per handoff, 0.94 points per pick and rolls. And that's, like I said, lows since their first series ever. That's in part due to Jokic forgetting how to shoot threes. I mean, ever since he came back from injury and the injury in January, he hasn't shot the ball the same, but also Murray himself. It did seem to me that Minnesota with Gobert playing Jokic better than he ever has, McDaniels being absolutely incredible defensively with their athleticism and length, those two alone and everybody else around them. Once you stop that two-man game, there was literally nothing else on Denver. And I think for Jokic, like, he's been the initiator and the finisher for 7 years now straight, pretty much. I mean, Murray did some of it, of course. Michael Porter Jr., you know, and it was helpful and as a shooter, as a weapon and all that too. But like, if they don't have that, I feel like Denver did not have any other answers at all. And that's a major concern that's hard to fill when you also have defensive concerns that you have to address. Right. And this is where I'm so worried with Denver from a roster construction standpoint and from a lack of assets moving forward standpoint. They have their 2026 first rounder and then they have swaps. That's it. Their 2027 and 2029 first go to the Thunder. Woohoo!
It's not pretty. Yeah, it's not pretty.
I mean, they're top five protected, but I mean, wow, more picks in the Thunder. Whoopee. It's just a tough spot. I know, it's frightening. Where do you go from here, Adam? There's so many issues to address in Denver right now. What's the number one most important thing?
Well, I think you have to look at your identity, and first you have to say what is possible. Like, how much can Denver overhaul? Because to your point, I don't think Christian Brown is necessarily tradable. He's just beginning a huge extension. He has torn ligaments in his foot this year, and he was struggling all year. I think he'll bounce back, but will he bounce back well enough to be worth that even in a trade? I doubt it. So now you look at it and say, is Aaron Gordon, who's essential to what the team does, but now we're talking about two playoffs runs where he wasn't healthy, and it doesn't feel like an abnormality. It actually feels like every year you're going to be lucky if you get four straight rounds of health from Aaron Gordon. And yet if you pull him out of the system, it all falls apart. Can you commit to it? So I think you look really hard at Aaron Gordon and say, can we rely entirely on him being healthy in the playoffs? And if not, are there other players we can target that might be able to give us a similar look? You do have to cover for Jokic defensively with rim protection. Denver didn't have that without Aaron Gordon and Peyton Watson. But even still, do you need three or four of those guys as opposed to one or two? And then I think you have to look at the Jamal Murray piece of this, because he is another piece that's tradable. And this is what's tough. I agree that I think that two-man game is as good as we have seen over the last 10, 15 years. But if it can be taken out, if there is a magic bullet to it and it's on-ball pressure, the question becomes, could that have been alleviated with another ball handler? If instead of Cam Johnson, you have like a Paul George, we'll just say, another guy who could enter and be the trigger point for your offense, does that mitigate that weakness and now it's back to being fully operational? Or is there something about Minnesota showed that Jamal Murray, for as great as he is, he's a player that can be canceled out? And if that's the case and you have defensive limitations, you can no longer believe in that two-man game. I'm inclined to think that there's a little bit of this that Denver could build, you know, more ball handling, more athleticism, and a backup for Aaron Gordon. Maybe they had that this year in Peyton Watson. We just never saw it. I don't know. Denver, I think their best option might be to work those margins, because I just don't think they're going to get great return on their other more tradable assets.
What is the option, though? I mean, like, what are you going to do on the margins? It's like, it's not a lot of draft capital, not on their side of things. Who knows how a rookie would even contribute from the late first round? Not a lot of cap flexibility for free either. So, what's the option here when it comes to trading? Is it just trades? Is that the only path?
So I think about it this way. There's a handful of teams that are exactly opposite of Denver right now. Denver has a lot of skilled players, you guys that can shoot and do different things, but they don't have a lot of defense or toughness or athleticism. But you have teams like Orlando and Detroit and Houston. You can maybe make a case for Portland. Minnesota maybe even falls in this category. You have teams that are the exact opposite. They have a lot of toughness, a lot of athleticism, a lot of defense, but they need the soft skills that Denver maybe has in abundance. Cam Johnson is an example of this. Cam Johnson would probably help out an Orlando team that clearly needs more shooting, or maybe even a Detroit team that clearly needs more spacing. And he could be that, like, you know, he's a solid defensive player. He's not a great one, but he's solid. So both of those teams, I think, would look at Denver and say, yeah, we could really use that. Denver, on the other hand, was number one in three-point percentage this year. And last year, that was, I think, what they looked at against OKC. And they said, well, we need more shooting. And so let's add it. Well, what did that get them this year, being the number one three-point shooting team? Nothing, because in the playoffs, it's a completely different question. So I think Denver has to look for trade partners that are on the opposite end of the spectrum. And there are a handful of them I just mentioned. But there are teams that are probably looking at a Cam Johnson and saying, yeah, we could use that a lot. And we have an excess of these types of players that would have helped Denver in that series.
All reports indicate that they're going to stick with David Adelman. Is that a mistake?
I don't know. To be honest, I know that's a soft answer here. You look at it, he did a great job last year. If you just look at Denver's run last year, they were very competitive with Oklahoma City and made adjustments throughout that series. This year was frustrating, and I think Denver shot themselves in the foot. I'll tell you one way. You get to game six, they're going to their third string. Terrence Shannon Jr. can get to the rim. We know that. Clark is athletic. You know what they didn't want to do? Shoot a bunch of threes. They only made seven threes in that game while they kept getting to the paint. And if I'm Denver, I just say, you know what? Pack the paint, go zone, do something that says, can this group hit a bunch of tough three-pointers? Because we know they can get to the rim and finish. So I think he had mistakes throughout the course of this season, and he certainly didn't instill confidence, you know, throughout it, as he kind of, I think, started to waver as that series went on in some ways that are public. But at the same time, I think my default position is that most coaches, he was brought in to be an X's and O's tactician. I think he's mostly okay at that. And the problems with the Nuggets had more to do with their roster and maybe perhaps even just being stale. I mean, this is a team that has been together for 6-7 years. And sometimes even good teams with good plans just run out of, you know, they just expire. And Denver might have expired.
I mean, look, like you said, he was supposed to be an X's and O's upgrade over Malone. I didn't feel like it was that much different. And like you said, he coached a great playoff last year, going to a game seven against OKC, pulled a lot of the right strings in that series, went to zone in that series. Yep. He dictated the way in which OKC was running their offense. They took almost half their shots from three. They don't want to do that. That was because of the zone. Yep. And that is what one of the things that's so shocking. I mean, like, you would think that's what he would have went to in a moment where Minnesota's getting to the rim at will, is go back to what worked last year against the
Denver
Thunder.
Was shook. He was shook. Like, he was shook, and the entire roster, I think, was honestly shook from this. And so I do blame him, and I do think he had a bad playoffs, but you do have to also balance that with, one, Jokic went out. This is the most time he's ever missed in a series, in a season. He missed this year with that bone bruise. They stayed afloat. He did a great job in that moment, you know, kind of rallying them. So he has some pluses and minuses. I think he really failed in this playoffs, but I also think Murray failed. I also think everybody failed. The Christian Brown failed. Jokic failed. Everybody, all the Nuggets, the full system failed in this playoff run.
Now, I'm curious on the topic of Jokic. There's probably some people listening to this podcast like, you guys are ignoring Jokic. You're barely talking about Jokic. He failed. He struggled in the first round. Well, we're getting that here, because here's what I want to ask you, Adam. Jokic, I mentioned earlier, I've talked about this for a couple of weeks now, the loss of the three-pointer and how that affected his game, affected the two-man game between him and Murray. It was a domino effect is what it caused without the lack of the three. It led to less driving lanes for Murray. Jokic wasn't able to solve Gobert, not able to score as much in the half court. It led to more transition up and down from Minnesota. That hurts your defense, yada, 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 so on and so forth. With Jokic against Gobert specifically, Jokic in the past has not needed to shoot threes well for Denver's offense to operate.
Yeah.
Well, he became a higher volume guy. He was shooting 40%+ last year, 45% pre-injury this year. He wasn't as high volume as, you know, last year or the year prior. What was the difference, Adam? Like, why did Gobert have so much more success one-on-one against Jokic this year compared to past years, in your opinion? I have his jersey hanging over my shoulder, so I'm a little biased here.
Gobert's?
Yeah, I've
already got Gobert's jersey. Oh, look at that. That's hilarious.
From the best defender of our generation to Kevin.
Oh, wow. There you go, your boy. That's hilarious, man. That's incredible. Here's what I say. First of all, in that game seven that they lost in 2024, I can't remember what Jokic was in that game. It was like 2 of 11 from three. So this has been a thing where Minnesota has said, of all the things that Jokic can do, shooting threes has the most variance. And we, like, if push comes to shove, we'll try it out. But here's the truth of it. No two players have played each other as much, have gone up against each other as much as those two have in the play-by-play era. This is not a new thing. This is not like, you know, when people are looking at this, like, did he figure something out about Jokic? In my opinion, no. But you look at it and say, Gobert, and this is not an excuse, Jokic came up small. Like, I thought he wasn't aggressive enough in some of the middle portions of the series. Even if you're missing, sometimes you just have to, like, put your head down and keep going until you draw fouls or just, you know, rally the team behind you. And he came up short in that. So this is not an excuse for Jokic. But Gobert had the easiest matchup against Jokic that he's ever had. He didn't have to worry about the pick and roll. That was blown up. There's no pick and roll coverage. There was no pick and roll. Murray never broke free of Jaden McDaniels in the series, not once. So he didn't have to worry about that. Aaron Gordon was gone. He didn't have to worry about the pressure behind him, you know, because there's no lob threat. There's no rebound threat. He got to, and then their coverage allowed for the other three guys just to stay home on shooters. So now the kickout passes aren't there. Gobert had to focus on guarding Jokic, not worrying about anything else other than just him, not worrying about the pass, the pick and roll, or anything else. And I think it just bothered Jokic, especially in that middle period of the series. And then on top of that, you know, Jokic was playing 40 minutes every single night by design. I thought part of Minnesota's game plan was you want to bring Big Val in to start a second quarter, give Jokic a rest. Well, they'd go to their small lineups in those moments and really spread the court. Val struggled at that, and Jokic ends up coming back a little bit early. So they were able to pull every lever to make this difficult against Jokic in the series, and he came up small. You know, it's not an excuse. That's what great players do is, okay, the toughest circumstances are laid out. Can I overcome that now with great shot making? And if there's one takeaway that diminishes Jokic from this, in my opinion, that's like long term, he does everything on the offensive end, and we think of him as everything. I think we saw the limitations of his individual shot making. And maybe it was just a bad series. Maybe he just shot the ball well. But what really needed to break Gobert was just go one-on-one and hit some tough shots. And he came up short. He missed a lot of the ones that we expect him to make.
Yeah, he did. I mean, and part of that's Gobert. Part of it's, as you said, Gobert didn't have to focus on those other issues. I mean, it's a great point. Gordon in the dunker spot, Gordon corner three, like, it's just not a concern when he's literally not out there. And Nate McDaniel's just completely destroyed Murray in the entire series. That's all true. And we'll be right back after this break. I think with Jokic, part of my personal disappointment, and like, I didn't vote Jokic this year. I had him third on my ballot. Some Nuggets fans think I'm anti-Jokic. I'm not anti-Jokic. I love Jokic. I've loved him for a long time.
I had him second, and they hate me too. So we're in the same boat over here.
You have SGA first, I assume, not Wemby.
Yeah.
Am I still alone? SGA am I still one. The only person that's had a Wemby vote? Am I still alone?
You're
there?
A little early. I think you're a little early, but we'll see. We'll see.
I don't know. It's like the Fargo poster, the fish. Maybe you're right and they're wrong.
All right. We'll I love this.
we'll see in the Western Conference Finals. We'll see there. I might be early, but we'll see. But like, anyway, yeah. I do love Jokic. But what disappointed me in that series is two things. I didn't think he made the same impact defensively as we've seen in past postseasons. I thought it was a little bit more Ole getting to the basket. That's in part maybe due to the injury. I think he was a bit better earlier in the season prior to the injury, but that still was disappointing to me. And then secondly, as you said, the aggression on the post. In the middle of the series, I wrote on Yahoo Sports how, you know, Jokic's three has fallen apart. Forced some post-ups against Gobert. As you just said, just go for it. Just go one-on-one and try to hit some tough shots. To me, it felt like Jokic wasn't doing that, but he was also just in his own head. Some of the passes he made were just so sloppy and out of character for him. To me, it felt like the Wolves and Gobert specifically got under his skin and turned him into the type of player that we're not just used to watching. And Jokic's going to be better there. It reminded me of a younger version of Jokic sometimes where he would get flustered more often and he would protest and not shoot threes or not shoot at all. It was like, that's what it felt like. And then the McDaniels thing at the end of the game and, you know, all that stuff that happened, it just felt like he was just in his own head going a little wild.
Yeah, I'll give him a bit of a pass on the post-up thing just because I don't think Denver could get him the ball in the post. I mean, this is part of why they couldn't, you know, they didn't run it a lot is they literally couldn't get the ball to him. And so for him to post up, it just took so much energy to have to back down and get there on his own. So he just didn't go to it. But the other part I think is very important. The defense, the low light reel was really bad this year. It's not all on him. They were able to put this pressure, but he didn't solve it at all. He didn't help out, and it looked really, really rough. And then the part you said, though, about you still come down to, was it game three when he gets the floater to tie the game with like a couple seconds left, and instead he sends it down to Christian Brown? And it's those type, that play was high profile because, one, you're the best player in the world. Take that shot. You know, like, it's your favorite shot is the floater. Anthony Edwards is the rim protector. You can make that over Wemby. You can definitely make it over Anthony Edwards. And more to the point, the team needed to see you make it. They didn't need to see you drop it off and Christian Brown hit free throws. They needed to see you make the shot when it mattered. And it would have changed, in my opinion, the dynamic of it. And too often in the series, he was frustrated. And I'll tell you this, Kevin, this is one thing his haters have said about him this year that I think is unfortunately true. I think that OKC series really affected him last year, in part because of the physicality and because the foul calls that are afforded to OKC the other way, that I think Jokic turned into a flopper this year. I just think he did. I think he went full, all right, well, then I'm going to try to do this stuff too. And you even saw it in the playoffs when you said it reminded you more of early career Jokic. I agree. He was too caught up in the little frustrations of the series, including with Jaden McDaniels, you know, at times, and Jalen Clark. Jalen Clark totally tried to lure him into a technical, and Jokic came this close to falling for it. It was the world's most obvious bear trap, and Jokic walked into it and like caught himself at the last second. And it's like, yeah, man, unfortunately, you can be suckered into these things, and you're trying to draw fouls when it's like, man, this series isn't about fouls. They're letting anything go. You just got to go do it.
Jokic was so close to turning into one of his brothers. So close.
So close. And it would have been so embarrassing. Like, what a horrible way for that series. I mean, they end up losing the game anyway. But it would have been worse if he gets thrown out in the third quarter because he couldn't control his temper of a must-win game. And he was this close to it.
Oh, my God.
And Jalen Clark knew what he was doing. Jalen Clark was not being earnest in that. Like, he was trying to, like, push and... What are you going to do about it? And as soon as he touched him, he flops. Like, he almost had it. He almost got it.
It's so good. I mean, great job by Jalen Clark and the Wolves probably coaching
honestly,
staff
truly.
For nudging him on. Really a good job pushing that.
Totally.
Is there anything we missed with Denver? I mean, I'm curious. You know, you cover the team every day. You think about the team every day. What's something that nationally people aren't talking about enough when it comes to the state of the Nuggets?
I think we kind of hit on all of it. The difficulty Denver is going to have in kind of turning this around and the different avenues. I mean, I see three avenues. Run it back, work the margins, add more athletes, you know, replace Tim Hardaway Jr. and Bruce with more athletic guys if you can. That's one avenue. Moving on from Murray is one of them, is an avenue. Like, do you just give up on the two-man game and you can get two or three players for Murray and that's the new formula? You just put athletes and defenders around Jokic. I think there is a real case that that might be the best avenue, and maybe they do it. And then the other one is trading AG. If you are trying to make a trade for somebody that has value, I still think teams would look at AG and can absorb his risk injury. So it's going to be interesting to see which way Denver goes. But more to the point, they've never had this. They've never been in this moment. Even if they don't make a move, how do they respond from falling? They were in a ascent mode. You win the title and you're kind of in the plateau. This is the first time they clearly are no longer at the plateau. They're down. They have dropped a level. So how do they handle that? It'll be interesting.
We will see if they are a team that it feels like the decline is here and this is it. The window is shut. Or if they're able to rejuvenate and they're right back like the Spurs, you know, in the Tim Duncan days where it felt like, oh, this is it. The Spurs are over. Well, here they are winning a finals against the Heat. Here they are with Kawhi Leonard
reinventing
coming out of nowhere. Yes, reinventing themselves. And guess what? That's what the Spurs did. They were Twin Towers in the late 90s and early 2000s. And, you know, really, really innovated the corner three in the late 2000s. Moved to the beautiful game in the early 2010s. And then with Kawhi Leonard, as Duncan was really getting older, they used a little bit more ISO. And, of course, from there they didn't win afterwards. But they Popovich, in the prime of his coaching career, was always changing the system around to best utilize his players and best find edges in the NBA. And that's to your point earlier, you used the word stale with the Nuggets. Maybe it's just stale and it's time to evolve the system a bit, add more layers to the offense, because they cut the head off the snake, Minnesota did. And that's why they're in a second round series here against the San Antonio Spurs. And boy, what a challenge this is going to be for the Minnesota Timberwolves against San Antonio. That game one is tonight, so a quick turnaround. We don't have to spend a lot of time in the series. We'll be reacting to game one tomorrow on my show with my Tuesday game one reaction episode. But I do want to talk about it, though, Adam, because Anthony Edwards has become questionable for tonight's game. And I would imagine moving from out to doubtful to questionable, bodes well for his return either in game one or two. So I want to think about it in the context of Anthony Edwards is back for the Timberwolves. What needs, if the Timberwolves upset the Spurs here, what's the story at the end of the series? Why did it happen?
Well, I would say it's because they have to score. I mean, I'm almost answering this in reverse order in that why I think this is going to be a really tough series for Minnesota. Denver was not good defensively, as we just highlighted. And yet the Wolves only posted a 112 offensive rating. They still, like, it feels like they scored whenever they wanted. But the truth is they had an average offense, basically, average playoff offense. And San Antonio is going to be significantly more difficult to score on than Denver was. For one, Wemby's the opposite of Jokic as a second line defender. He blocks everything. He scares you off. So if you're not getting to the paint for 60 plus paint points every single game against Wemby the way you were against Jokic and the Nuggets, then automatically you say, well, now your league average offense, when we all felt like we had a great offensive round, a great offensive series, now, and it was still average, what does that look like against a great defense? So if they win, I assume it's going to be because they found a way to score against that Spurs team effectively and consistently. And that probably means role players making some three-point shots, but it probably means, like in the first round, where you get big contributions from some guys that you didn't fully expect to get big scoring outputs from. Ayo Dosunmu, 43-point game. You do expect it from Julius Randle. You're going to need it in this round. Maybe even Terrence Shannon Jr., a big quarter or big half. You're going to need performances like that from other guys.
I think that's spot on. They're just not going to get to the rim as often. Period. End of story.
No way.
When Wemby's out there, there's literally nothing you can do about it. It's just, you're not going to get to the rim as much. Okay. Like it's good luck. You're not going to. And if you do get to the rim, you're going to get blocked and you're not going to perform well. I think that's a big part of it. I do wonder, like, considering how well Minnesota played against Jokic, is there any way to have some level of success slowing down what Wemby does in terms of impacting the game directly, but also beyond the box score with what he does with his gravity inside, opening up catch and shoot opportunities on the perimeter? Is there anything Gobert can do against him one-on-one, not needing to bring help into the paint as often as teams often do when Wemby is inside? That's a big question there as well. And I mean, I don't think they're going to have as much success as they did against Denver with Wemby as a shooter. Wemby likely will shoot better than Jokic did last round, considering the loss of Jokic's jumper temporarily, you'd think. But I think that's a key as well, because I think defensively, when the Spurs are on defense, you know, they're going to have to shoot well. But also, what about when he's on offense too?
This is more of, I would say, a concern for the Spurs than I would say a strength for Minnesota, although it is to some extent both. One thing I worry about San Antonio is I think they can fall into isolation or just slowing down. Like the game can get clunky for them in key moments. Oftentimes this is late, but sometimes it is like a second or third quarter run that was big for the game. And they defaulted down to being stagnant or to going to Wemby and like on the elbow or from the three-point line. And I just think that's a mistake. Wemby has gotten so good this year, in my opinion, at using his advantage off ball. Sometimes this is on cuts, but a large part of it is he has this huge wingspan and he'll put his arm up. Like he'll go down to the elbow or down to the short, the pinch post or the block, and he'll put his arm up like this. And the defender has to go all the way to the right side of him because that arm is so big that it's like, I can't just stay behind him. I'll never contest it. And the moment he goes over here, he'll put the arm up over on this side. And all of a sudden, you have to go to the other side. He's so good at putting this rim pressure without, usually that's a dive, like I'm rolling to the rim and jumping, and that's the rim pressure. He's just so good at using his length to draw help side defense in, or if they don't suck in, then he gets the ball and scores. And I think that's when they're at their best. When the ball is moving and they're doing different things and Wemby puts pressure on you that way, they're not at their best when you throw him the ball and clear out. So I think that if San Antonio, the test is going to be in key moments when the game is getting tight, do they slow down, ISO up, and does he deliver in those moments? Or do they keep trusting their process and just break through when Minnesota does go on defensive runs?
I think you bring up a really good point. And this, whether it happens this round against Minnesota or next round, I'd assume against the Thunder, I don't see the Lakers beating OKC. There will be a moment, there will be a game or multiple games that it's going to turn into slow down, can't run your sets, one-on-one. We saw Wemby have success doing that against the Suns. He had a game winner against the Suns, a buzzer beater off the dribble. We've seen him missing those opportunities as well. We've seen Fox just take over the ball in those situations too with mixed results. What does that look like in that in this playoff environment? And I think for the Spurs, if Minnesota challenges them, that could be a good thing for them to get those, that experience instead of a sweep, you know, beating them in four or five before OKC. True. Maybe it would be a good thing to get those reps. And Minnesota's tough. Yeah. I think Minnesota probably will at least create one of those games if it's not a deep series. So at least have some close games.
And on the other side, can Minnesota force that? Because they have such good on-ball pressure. They have so many defenders. Can they not let the ball get popping? And they're not. It's not that San Antonio's trying to ISO, but that they just get fall into it because it's so hard to move off ball and do these other things. I think that'll be something to watch. And if I'm Minnesota, I'm praying for that. But you know what? You have momentum because that's exactly what you did in round one. So can you do it again in round two and make a team uncomfortable? We'll see. I just love Minnesota. I will say this. I hope they get Ant back. I just love, they have so many tough dudes and they have an identity that like can withstand. This is one of the things the playoffs test is your identity solid enough to withstand punches? And they lost two starters. And you know what they played game six like? Just like they played when they had those guys. They looked the exact same just with new guys. That is an identity that is tough and can withstand things. And I hope they get their guys back the best they can to be able to continue this run.
I can't wait to see how they come out opening possession, how they're defending Victor Wembanyama. Is it going to be Randall on Wemby with Gobert helping off of, you know, Castle in the corner, leaving him wide open? Are they going to give him the Tony Allen treatment and live with the results? I'm so excited for this series. I mean, I think tonight's games, could be pretty awesome. I mean, could be pretty, pretty awesome. Yeah. So I'm very excited for it. With the Rockets, they have been eliminated by the Los Angeles Lakers. I'll tell you what, Adam. Midway through the series, I started writing a story for Yahoo Sports about, you know, the Slim Reaper has come again. You know, he came for the Nets. He came for the Suns, and now he's come for the Rockets. We didn't publish it yet. I need to figure out the right angle for it here, but because he didn't play in the first round. He played a game. He had 9 turnovers. He wasn't so good in it, but he didn't play. So it's very hard to judge. That said, I do look at this Rockets team, and you talked about the paths forward for Denver. Like, there's multiple ways to go about it. I think for the Houston Rockets, one of them is easily run it back. Get Steven Adams back, Fred VanVleet back, play with the team that you thought you were going to have. And just the young guys another year older and just move forward with that. But I think there is a world in which this Rockets organization should look at, hey, these young guys played with some pretty good energy. They were flying around defensively against the Lakers. Full court press, Amen Thompson bothering everybody he's defending. I mean, like, they played really well defensively. I think there is some logic to at least thinking about maybe we find a new destination for Kevin Durant and just go back to the youth movement. It's not like they gave up a lot to get KD. It's not like they had to mortgage their whole future. They still have that path forward. Am I off base here and even thinking about a trade KD path?
I mean, when you see how the season ended, there's just, how can you be off? Everything's on the table. That was a really bad showing against a shorthanded Lakers team. And I mean, very similar to Denver. And KOC, the thing that's so frustrating about this one is, who didn't see this coming when Fred VanVleet went down? And it's just bad luck. But, you know, there was a lot of people that are like, it's fine. This year is just a grow year and blah, blah, blah. And then we'll get to next year. And then everybody comes back. And you think, just put yourself in these shoes. A whole season goes through and you lose. It's almost, you almost never have the confidence that you had in the team going into it. Oh, it's fine. We kind of know we're going to lose, so we'll go in and do this. It almost never works that way. It feels bad. Frustrations grow. Identities get solidified, you know, within a team. So I'm with you. I do like Amen Thompson's one of my favorite players. I love that guy. Jabari had a good showing. And then Şengün's been a little up and down, but they do have some young pieces. I just look at this and say, sometimes bad luck falls on you. And you have to just be honest with it. Bad luck fell on the Rockets. They played it out for a whole year, and now everything feels worse. So that's the situation they're in, and I'm with you. I would pivot if I were them, but we'll see what they do. Easy for me to say.
Yeah, it is easy to say, and that's part of it. Like, not many teams wanted Kevin Durant 1 year ago. He's another year older, and he allegedly had DMs leaked where he talked poorly about Jabari Smith and Alperen Şengün, his current teammates, and never mind the things said about former teammates as well. What did he call Booker? Booker, like Hitler or something, Stalin? And I forget. Vogel and Booker. I mean, like, come on. Like, what are you doing?
If that was true, if it's true, yeah. Like, the team knows whether it's true or not. I know, but yes. Like, they'll keep it secret. It feels like it's true, but I mean, whatever. I'll keep the reasonable doubt open. The team knows. If it was true, you can't come back from that. I really don't think you can.
I agree. I agree.
So what are we doing?
I know. I don't think you can. I mean, like, KD is somebody who has said in the past, I'm not a leader. I'm not a vocal leader. I'm not a rah-rah guy. It's like, well, yeah, no doubt. We can tell. That's been pretty obvious. But also, it's the type of thing, like, if I'm Jabari Smith, I can't ever look at him the same way. Like, you can forgive it and move on and be a professional right. And all that. And that's what I think they did this year. You can see him giggling Agreed. And laughing on the bench. You're a professional. You're a grown man, right? Like, go about your job as best you can. But I don't think you can ever reach the heights that you are supposed to or aspire to after something fully like agreed. That transpires. I don't. And that's where I look at Houston. I'm shopping KD. I'm looking around the league and thinking about who's a desperate team that needs shooting.
There's a lot of them.
There's definitely a lot of them, right? So, like, I'm looking around, and maybe there'd be more this year for Kevin Durant than there were last year. So that's where I'm thinking with Houston. But I think the flip side of it is the other side of it. It's keeping KD and going for Giannis, giving up Şengün, giving up future picks, and becoming an older team trying to compete right away. And I think there's some logic to that, but I don't like going from the youngest, fastest, up and coming team in the league to the oldest. Yeah. You know, with some whiny stars that are very moody. I don't like the idea of that. I mean, I like the idea of Giannis on paper, but not with KD. I don't like that path, Adam.
I don't know if I like it or hate it. I think that these windows in today's NBA, we're just seeing that there's a couple teams that feel like they'll be open forever. Oklahoma City and San Antonio. I mean, it feels like they're going to have a 10-year run at this. We'll find out how it plays out. But I see every other team. I mean, even Boston all of a sudden finds themselves scrambling and in a situation of, do we have too many deficiencies? How do we pivot? Denver feels that way. So part of me looks at this and says, nobody should feel bad about pivoting into a plan 1 or 2 years into it. That's just the new NBA. Orlando Magic, you had a nice young core. Might be time to pivot away from that entirely, and it doesn't feel that way. But you can rise and fall if you're just willing to say pivot to whatever. Giannis and Kevin Durant, yeah, that team's already halfway there.
We'll be right back. I'm curious about your thoughts on trends and things learned throughout these playoffs, especially when it comes to incoming draft classes, building the right roster. And in the postseason right now, only one of the top 11 three-point shooting teams in terms of attempts per game is still in the playoffs. It's the Cleveland Cavaliers, and they were nearly eliminated by the Raptors, a team that doesn't shoot threes well. Is there anything to take from that? You know, you mentioned Denver was number one in three-pointers this year, and they're gone. Anything to learn from that, or is that just a little blip, you think?
No, I think there's always something to learn. The league is evolving really fast right now. This is one of my core beliefs, is that the league just keeps moving. Like, every year, everyone studies what happened in the playoffs and says, like, this is where the league is going. And here's the evolution I see it, and where this year plays into it. You know, 10 years ago, it was shooting. Every team needs shooting now. We have to get shooting on the court, and if you don't have that, you're sunk. There's so many players that can shoot in the NBA right now that it's like, it's almost unfathomable from where we were 10 years ago to just think that by default, most teams are going to have 5 or 6 guys that are very reliable three-point shooters. So then it became, okay, well, they have to be 3-and-D, and then they have to be high IQ players. A lot of these young guys coming into the league right now are very polished. And they have, like, a good feel for the game, a high IQ. You look at even like a Dylan Harper. You look at Oklahoma City and you look at San Antonio. Both of those teams have young guys that are wise beyond their years in terms of basketball feel, basketball IQ. And I just think it's the same with shooting. These guys are growing up in a league that's evolving, and they're aiming, as they develop into the best versions of themselves, they're aiming at these hyper versatile players that can shoot and read a complex offense. And So this year it becomes the physicality, the athletic defense part of it. It used to be just specialists, give us spacing. Now I think it is that you have these high IQ athletic players who also happen to be able to shoot and dribble. And so you're looking at that type of versatility being so important across the league.
How about the non-shooters? Guys like Amen Thompson, Ausar Thompson, like they are unbelievable defensive players and they fly around and they make winning plays, grab rebounds, push the ball ahead. But in the half court, they are non-factors of shooters aside from the two clutch threes. You know, we saw Amen Thompson hit in a game against the Lakers. These guys don't shoot. They're not threats. Is there a place for those guys, or is there pressure on them to become good shooters? Like Aaron Gordon went from a subpar shooter to a good shooter all of a sudden. It happened overnight, seemingly. What's your thought on that aspect?
I think it's not that it's impossible. It's just that it is a major mark against you. It's like every team, when they build a roster, it's like you can get three strikes. Oh, we don't have a rim protector. That's one strike. So we're going to have to make up for it in this other area. Oh, you don't have enough shooting? Okay, that's a strike now. Now you have two strikes, and we have to make up for it in another area. So to me, it's not, when I'm talking about it used to be shooting and then it evolved to this versatility, I don't mean in replace of, I mean on top of. You have to have shooting, and you have to have athletes, and you have to have high IQ players. But the league seems to be producing a lot of young players in particular that come in, like A.J. Mitchell is a young player, but man, he plays like a veteran. He can defend, he can shoot, he can handle. We're getting more and more of these types of players, and not just the stars, including the A.J. Mitchell types, these middle and late first rounders that come in with just a weird amount of polish relative to what we were seeing 10 years ago when it felt like the 22nd pick was going to be a really raw player with a lot of athleticism or a shoot-only guy with no other skills. I just think we're getting guys that now are stacking all these skills up, and you're seeing them come into the league in volume.
I mean, it's kind of like the evolution of the big, right? Like there's at one point not a lot of bigs that shot threes, and then bigs come in and a lot of them start shooting threes. Now some of them have handles and they can be initiators, whether it's Jokic types or, you know, the Wemby types. It's just becoming, or the Karl Anthony Towns types. It's, you know, it's a different range of types of skills. And I think the amount of bigger ball handlers as well, whether it's the Luka types or, you know, like I said, the Jokic and Wemby types. Small guards. There's definitely more coming in. Boozer is going to run a lot of pick and roll. DeBons is 6'9". There's a lot of them this year.
Monster.
There's small guards that have found success. Tyrese Maxey just was amazing in the first round against the Boston Celtics. He looked like Allen Iverson finishing at the rim. At times he looked like a Damian Lillard from the perimeter, bringing great value in the postseason. But then there's a Reed Shepard just getting overpowered on the defensive end of the floor. He made some plays, you know, he had the steal on LeBron. He was a defensive playmaker, but he was small. It's just the reality of it. And I think he's just one example, but I think across the league, we'll see how this postseason develops as well. Like will Deuce McBride with the Knicks become a problem in this round against the Sixers? We'll see. Who knows? There's a lot of small guards in this year's draft class, Adam. And this has just been a thought on my mind with the conversations I'm having with executives and agents and scouts around the league. It's like, what does it mean for small guards? Is there still a great value in the league for smaller guards? How do you see it based off of what you've been seeing in the playoffs this year and in recent years?
I love this question because I think it has an interesting answer. And when we think about what causes Jokic the most trouble is when he has like a guard on him, because there is something too, where you have the leverage. I've got a tall guy and now I can be leveraged and right up into his space. I think when you're an undersized guard, like Davion Mitchell, for example, he doesn't lose the size advantage. You should be able just to like back him down and shoot over him, but he is able to play into your space so much that it actually, his height in a weird way becomes an advantage in certain places on the floor, like in the backcourt or behind the three-point line, where he can just really get into you and move with you. And there's a bunch of defenders that can play this way. So I would say the short guard has to be able to do that. If you're not one, and Reed Shepard's not one that can do this, this is part of the problem. So I think the thing with Reed Shepard is that you have to be able to get into a offensive player space. You look at Davion Mitchell, he's able to like get right into ball handlers, like right up against him. And it's actually an advantage when we talk about outside the three-point line, full court. That small size almost allows you to like cut them off at the knees. You know how the leverage defensively against them. And we see this a lot, that it's like a type of defender. You want to have types, long athletic defender with long wingspan, strong, stocky Lou Dort type defender. And then sometimes you want the little guy that's just like can get right under you and cut you off at the knees. So I think that if you're going to be an undersized guard with speed, you have to be able to do that, because at least then you have a defensive role that you can deploy and say, okay, we're going to unleash him to do this thing. But if you can't do that, if you're a defensive player who's small but also can't get into somebody's space, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of use for you.
I think like Kayson Wallace is a good example of that as well. Another guy in OKC. Yep. He's 6'2"-ish without shoes on. He's listed at 6'3". He's not big, but he's got a long wingspan. And he's just so stout, so strong, and so skilled, yeah, and smart defensively as well. Like guys like that, it's kind of funny. I mean, OKC, defending champions, they're the team with like some smaller players in their backcourt. I mean, Lou Dort is huge. He's wide, but he's not super tall. He's only 6'3", 6'4", as well. And yet they find exactly that type you're talking about. Not a coincidence, maybe, that Oklahoma City has done a good job at that.
It's such a valuable piece, man, and it's part of a broader defensive puzzle. So if you have that, if you're small like that, and by the way, Jared McCain's a good example of this too. Not that he's tiny, but it's like you watch him play defense in Philadelphia, and it is like slide and move your feet, keep the ball in front of you. And then he goes to OKC, and it's like, no, attack the ball. Don't give him anything. Get like right up on him. And I do think that there's a shift like Denver. I keep thinking this about Denver. Maybe they don't have the personnel to do it, but Denver at all times is trying to not get beat. I think good defenses are trying to turn you over. They're getting into you. They're like attacking you from the defensive side. Obviously, Oklahoma City does this, and small guards are a part of it.
Since we're on, you know, we're talking about OKC here, they have their first, their second round series coming up against the Lakers. Is there anything to the fact OKC defends as aggressive as they do and as handsy as they are, and in a way that people think they're getting a unfair whistle that, hey, maybe we should just do this too. Maybe we should just draft players like this. Maybe we should just defend as aggressive as they do and will be officiated the same way. Is there anything to that, you think? Or is it just an unfair whistle like some people think?
So I do think that there's something too. This has just always been true, that you set the tone. You know, like you establish what your identity is over time, but also in a game, and they always establish that level of physicality. So they kind of in some ways earn it. I think what's interesting and why I think Shea, like by some Jokic fans in particular, or even Luka fans or LeBron fans, Shea will get undervalued sometimes in MVP conversations because he doesn't assist or rebound or do, like we think of these guys like Harden who does everything and we say it's more valuable. Part of this is that Shea is so good one-on-one and so good at not turning the ball over. Not only is he a system to score, but he's also a system to control the possession and control the tempo because he just doesn't turn it over, that it actually allows you to put defensive players all around him. One of the questions I have for Jokic going forward is, in theory, it's like, all right, just give him 8 defensive players around him. But Jokic's system requires guys to be able to handle the ball a little bit and cut and do different things. Whereas I think Shea takes care of so many things for you that you really only need to have to be able to defend and space. And as long as you do that, you can play for them. And it's why they're able to find so many guys. You're not asking them to be super dynamic at a lot of things. No, Caruso, just be ready to catch and shoot when you get it. Cut hard when you don't, and then play your butt off on defense. They have so many guys that they're only asked to do those things, and it's because of how good Shea is on offense and the type of way he is good on offense.
The fact we don't have any word on Luka's return, I don't think the series is going to go long at all, Adam. I think this could be a 4-game sweep without Luka. And even with Luka, hey, when he got hurt against OKC weeks back, they were down, what, like 40?
Yeah, it was like 40 points. Yeah.
It wasn't pretty. Is the argument? Yeah. Sorry, continue.
Well, no, you're going to say what is the argument that they can contend, and I don't have one for you. Exactly. Like, honestly, I just think that this Thunder team is really good. If Luka was healthy, maybe a little bit, but I don't see it, man. I'm with you. 4 games. If it goes 5 games, I'll be like, good job, Lakers.
That's exactly the way I feel. If I'm LeBron, I'm just like, "Woo! Thank goodness we avoided being the first NBA team.
Avoided the sweep.
Yes, we avoided that. We avoided giving up a 3-game lead. Like, thank goodness. If I'm LeBron James, whatever happens here, hey, you know, live with it. I don't. I don't think there's much of an argument for the Lakers. I think if Luka does return and if he looks like the Luka we saw at his peak in the middle of the season, hey, like he can, maybe he has a monstrous night and he can steal a game or two. But the Lakers are just in a transitional year. It's about what do they do this offseason? How do they build on this? And then next year, try to reload and become a team that can actually go toe-to-toe with the best in the West. That's the way I see it. Another team going through some changes. The Dallas Mavericks have hired Masai Ujiri as their president and alternate governor. This kind of comes as a surprise here. He was about to be running a WNBA team, and here we go. Now he is going to be running the Dallas Mavericks after years in Toronto, years in Denver. You had him out there at one point. Masai, great drafter for many years, willing to take risks as well. The DeMar DeRozan for Kawhi Leonard deal. Kawhi did not want to go there. He did it anyway. They win a championship after trading their face of the franchise, DeMar DeRozan. Beloved up there. He did it anyway. Last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of his tenure in Toronto was not so good. Pulled in many different directions with all everything he does around the world, Basketball Without Borders. It seemed like the Toronto Raptors ownership was ready to move on, and they did. But he goes here. It's a clean slate. He's had success. I'd imagine there'd be some level of motivation. I think it's a good hire for Dallas, considering their top options, the Tim Conley types, were not actually realistic.
I was rooting for Tim Conley. I'm not going to lie. I just think that would have been a perfect spot for him. Like, I love Tim Conley. I have so much appreciation for him. And I think rebuilding around a singular player, in this case, Cooper Flagg, I would have loved to have seen it happen. But Masai Ujiri, here's the question I have for Masai. And really, it's a question for the league at large. I wonder how much retread coaches are really valuable in a league that is evolving this quickly, that maybe you might be principled to things that were true as recently as 6, 7 years ago, but are no longer true because the league is evolving. And maybe it's a different type of brain, personality, skill set that is valuable as a coach in 2026 that was not true even of 2019. I think the same thing could be true of general managers and president of basketball operations. First of all, it is a different generation. I don't want to overstate this, but Gen X is coming through. It's a different type of person. They're different, you know, they have different ways of viewing the game and the world, and maybe you need a perspective on that is shifted. Then on top of that, the things that you might have valued in 2019 might not no longer be as impactful to the league now. So I'm curious with Masai Ujiri. He obviously was phenomenal in two spots, in Toronto, bringing him a championship, in Denver, bringing him to the conference finals in 2009. He was great, but I do wonder, actually, was he there in 2009? I think he was actually the 2013 team. Nonetheless, franchise record 57 wins. Nonetheless, he has been a good GM. But I am just kind of curious to see what translates. He wasn't out of the league for that long, but he wasn't that effective in Toronto at the end. And I'm curious, how much is he able to evolve with the league when I think evolution is the defining trait of the league right now?
I think it's a great point, and it makes me think about Chicago. Mark Stein over at the Stein Line on Sunday updated the Bulls search for their new general manager, and he mentioned how Matt Lloyd has the best shot, who works under Conley in Minnesota. But like some of the other names are interesting. Like Lloyd has been around a bit. Like he's definitely not a retread at all. But Dennis Lindsay has been around forever. So they do have the older candidate as well. But then they have Atlanta's Bryson Graham and Boston's Dave Lewin, who are two guys in their 30s, much younger. So it seems to me that like Chicago is looking old. They're looking at someone proven that hasn't had the opportunity in Lloyd. And then they're looking very young as well with Lewin and Graham. So it's a great thought and a great question, really, about general managers as well. Is there such a thing as being a retread GM like we think of retread coaches?
Right.
And we'll see. Here's the opportunity for Masai Ujiri to prove it in Dallas. And no better place to do it than with Cooper Flagg, another lottery pick. What an opportunity to build something really special there in Dallas. Kind of hard to screw it up around Cooper Flagg, but we'll see how Masai Ujiri does. Adam. Oh, thank you so much for joining me today, man. This is a hell of a lot of fun, man.
It was, man. We covered a lot of topics, and it was a lot of fun. I will say, with Masai Ujiri, it's always nice when you're replacing the most hated person. You know, like it's almost like you can't be worse than the previous guy. Like, really can't. So,
I know. There you go. I mean, good job for Masai. Oh, unless he trades Cooper Flagg tomorrow.
Oh man,
there is one way to be worse. that's what you can do is trade, but that's not going to happen. Adam, thank you so much for joining. People can check you out with DNVR. You cover the Nuggets there, and then 8 times per week you're on the All NBA show with Legs and Stein and Jason Timpf. Great job, man, and thanks for joining me today.
Appreciate it so much, man. Thank you.
Big thank you to Adam Matas for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy for producing today's episode. If you're wondering, hey, where's the Eastern Conference conversation? Well, listen to part one of the podcast from earlier today. Me and John Fanta talked about everything in the Eastern Conference, and we'll be back again tomorrow, Tuesday. New show every single week. Remainder of the playoffs. We're going on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday. So tomorrow we're going to be reacting to tonight's game ones. Can't wait for that. Very happy and very excited for the guest I have coming in on Tuesday. Have a good night, everybody. Enjoy game one.